From Vermont Public Radio, this is the podcast of Switchboard, a public affairs call-in program. Switchboard is produced by Vermont Public Radio and webcast at vpr.net. This podcast is made possible by VPR and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a contributing member at vpr.net.
Good evening and welcome to Switchboard on Vermont Public Radio. I'm Steve Zand in for Bob Kinzel. Production of Switchboard is made possible by the Lintelak Foundation, and our toll-free number is provided by Sovereignet. Well, how often have you wandered down a stream bed or driven through a cut in the mountains and seen a rock or formation that piqued your curiosity about Vermont's geology? Tonight you'll have an opportunity to satisfy that curiosity as we talk with two experts about the ground beneath our feet, how it was formed, what it's made of, how varied it is from one part of the state to another, and a variety of questions that we'll field from you at 1-800-639-2211. Vermont has a state mineral, if you didn't know. It's talc, and we have three state rocks, granite, marble, and slate. Maybe you're curious about those, or perhaps you're wondering about some of the ancient forces that shape Vermont's landscape. Again, our number, 1-800-639-2211. We're joined for tonight's conversation by Dr. Char Mertens, who's chair of geology, the geology department, that is, at the University of Vermont. Char Mertens, welcome.
Hi, Steve.
And Larry Becker is with us. Larry is Vermont State Geologist. Welcome back, Larry Becker.
Thanks, Steve.
I want to start by talking about a couple of projects that are near and dear to your hearts that you're both working on. And one of the most interesting geological aspects of Vermont, Char Mertens, is the Chazy Reef, a coral reef, which we wouldn't normally associate with Vermont, that's located up in the Champlain Islands in Isle LaMotte. Tell us a little about that reef.
Well, it's called the world's oldest coral reef, but ironically enough, coral are not really the main organism that built it, but they do make an appearance in the fossil record in those rocks. So they are internationally famous for that, but I think we can create a case that these fossil layers are the oldest fossil reef in the world. The reef is a very complex ecosystem where a wide diversity of organisms live in a biological interaction. And there's a particular time in Earth history where enough organisms had evolved that began to occupy this ecological niche. And it's preserved in the rocks in Vermont, particularly up in the Isle of Mott area, but also in some other parts of the state.
So how old is it? And if we go look at it, what do we see?
It's roughly around 450 million years old, and I know that's a big number. It's about three quarters of Earth history has gone before that particular time period. So it's actually, to a geologist, fairly recent, but to the average person, hundreds of millions of years is quite ancient indeed. When you go and look at it, you see a gray rock called limestone. And you can actually see the fossil organisms in that. Early quarrymen thought that the fossils were part of the fabric of the rock, and they actually called it marble by mistake. So in the quarrying trade, it's often called Vermont black marble. But those swirls are actually the remains of organisms.
And what is the existence of this reef in this location tell us about Vermont's geological history?
Well, actually, they're very important for that because they tell us a lot about the type of water, the water depth, the water salinity, the water temperature. And in particular, the reef environment exists in a very, very narrow range of latitudes in today's world, just a few degrees north or south of the equator. So by finding a reef rock in Vermont, it basically says that at that time in Earth history, Vermont was a tropical climate. Reefs also only live in marine water, salt water, so that is telling us that this area of Vermont was underwater. And reefs also only live in water depth that's 60 feet or so or more, or less in depth. So it's saying something about how deep the water was here as well. So, very different conditions, obviously, than we see in this part of Vermont.
So all those conditions existed here. It's not as though the land mass that Vermont is part of migrated from somewhere else in the distant past.
Well, actually, it did, too, from another data set entirely, from the magnetic record that's preserved in the rocks. We know that Vermont was actually physically located in the southern hemisphere 450 million years ago. Not just Vermont, but the whole part of North America that it was attached to was just south of the equator. And over that 450 million time span to today, it's obviously moved northward and rotated slightly to its present latitude.
Well, I almost hate to ask this, but are we still moving further north?
Well, the good news is not further north, but we are moving west.
And at what rate?
Less than a centimeter a year. You're not going to notice.
This reef is so important that there have been efforts to preserve it, right? And where do we stand in that effort?
Yeah, this is such an important educational resource. As I mentioned, it is the oldest example of a fossil reef in the world. And it's right here in our backyard for students of all ages to go and look at it. There have been some tremendous efforts in the past couple of years on the part of the Isle of Mott Preservation Trust and the Lake Champlain Land Trust to put various parts that you can see easily under preserved status so that you can go there on field trips with students and see signage in some of the localities, more to come, that explain what's there.
And by more to come, there's an information center or some sort of facility associated with the reef that'll open soon?
At some of the localities, there is signage already, but the big upcoming event on September 2nd, 16th, Saturday the 16th at 4:30, is actually the dedication of the Goodsell Ridge Preserve Visitor Center on Isle of Mott, which is going to showcase to the public the existence of a building which is going to be a research center and visitors center, and the plans for the nature walk through the fields where these rocks are exposed, with signage to come explaining what people are actually looking at.
And Larry Becker, state geologist, you've been working on a totally separate project that has to do with mapping groundwater in the state. What's that about?
Yeah, well, first, thanks to Char and the group up on the Champlain Islands that are doing all the work there, because they've done a great job. Well, the legislature back in 2003 asked about what the status of aquifer mapping in the state, and there has been some broad brush look at that. So we've been doing some piloting in regards to looking at the geology and how that really is the vessel that holds the water. And I like to say that geology is not only about rocks, but it's about dirt and water, because it's also about the mountain building periods. So some of the curiosity things people may be interested in out there relate to the mountain building, but it also has a practical benefit to understand where the groundwater is, and then how the glaciers retreated across Vermont left certain deposits on the landscape. And those are potentially good sources of groundwater. And so to speak a little bit about that in the geological sense, our mountains were built during the forces of continents coming together and uplifting the mountain ranges. And in that, new minerals grew perpendicular to those forces. And so there's a new kind of linear quality in our rocks that came from that. There was the original bedding in the rocks when the sediments were laid down in the ocean. And that has something to do with it as well. So the question is, are there partings along those, that linear quality that was built by the mountain building is one possibility where water has moved, can move along, as well as fractures that cut across those layers. And really, when you drill a well in Vermont in your backyard and you drill into the bedrock, you're really trying to get into the fractures, because water is moving along those
fractures. The waters and the spaces then between. Is there anything like, sometimes we might imagine underground rivers coursing through Vermont?
We wouldn't really see it exactly that way. The other thing that I was going to talk about, well, there are fractures, and so water can move along those fractures, and they're interconnected. The other thing I was going to talk about is the glaciers and how they retreated. And water ran off the ice in certain places. Basically, it melted off the uplands first. So there's a kind of deposit up on the uplands called till, which is big boulders and sand and gravel. But that's not really generally a very good aquifer. But waters have run off the ice and deposited sand and gravel in the valley bottoms. And if those get buried and those are saturated, then you can drill down and tap the water that's in the spaces between the grains. And so some could think of that as underground areas of an aquifer that's
well, that well knowing that, being able to map the groundwater, how does that help us? How do we use that information?
Well, the idea would be you would work your way, knowing the geology, again, the vessel, you work your way down. We also look at, since 1966, every time a well has been drilled, the drillers have had to report. And so we look at those data because there's the yield and the depth through the overburden. And so we put it's important to understand this curiosity part of geology, to understand how the glaciers retreated, how the mountains were built, so we can get a kind of a framework as to what that vessel may look like. And then we start to look at the water well data and see how that intercepts those deposits. And we begin to build from there. And then as you work your way down through this, you eventually do new drilling and do pump tests. You pump the water to see what the capability is. What is the sustainable yield?
So there, when you say sustainable yield, that implies that it's a finite resource, that it's a depletable resource.
Well, in Vermont, I mean, we have a lot of recharge because, of course, we have a wet period, particularly in the spring when the snow melts. But there can be competition in certain places where the geology is tight, mm-hmm. where wells can compete in terms, generally draw the water table down, and there can be a drought period, and that we've seen that occur in Vermont.
And do you see groundwater levels fluctuate, let's see, because of the weather?
Yeah, I know 2-3 years ago there was a dry period, and we could see in the long-term record that there was a deficit and that the groundwater levels had depleted. We see there's a rough network of groundwater monitoring wells around the state. And then I recently, with all this rain, they would come back, and also spring melt as well.
1-800-639-2211 is our number. Larry Becker is a Vermont State Geologist, and Char Mertens is Chair of the University of Vermont Geology Department. If you have come across some unusual rocks formations, or just your curiosity has been aroused by what you've seen as you've traveled around Vermont, now is an opportunity to have your geological questions answered. And as Larry Becker pointed out, when we say geology, we're not just talking about rocks. We're talking about soil. We're talking about water, ice, a whole variety of things. 1-800-639-2211. Now, Larry, somebody called and asked if the Green Mountains are some of the oldest in the world. He or she heard that.
There are older rocks up towards Canada in the 2-billion-year-old range. The core of the Green Mountains to the south, on the southern part of our Green Mountains, are about more than 1 billion years old. So that gets them there. They're about the same age as the Adirondacks. And then up in this area, up here in northern Vermont, things can range from, say, 600 million years in terms of the rocks that are there to about 400 million years, and then further east, 350 million years or so. And then that was all changed by heat and pressure as we had the mountain building period.
We mentioned the state mineral and state rocks. Char, I think we overlooked the state fossil.
Yes, Vermont has a state fossil, the Charlotte Whale.
Oh,
and
of course.
It's visible in the Perkins Museum of Geology at UVM.
All right, let's go to the phones and talk first with Dan, who's calling from Huntington. Hi, Dan.
Hi.
Hi, go ahead.
I'm a landscape mason, and I'm working with a stone called Pantonstone right now, and there's lots of fossils in that. And I was just wondering if about those fossils and what they are, and if you're familiar with that type of stone.
Thanks, Dan. Charmartins.
Yeah, Dan, the Pantonstone is actually known for two things. One, it's a great building stone, but secondly, it's a beautiful building stone because it does have a lot of fossils in it. And most of the fossils you're looking at are just slightly younger than the same ones I was talking about for the reef up in Isle of Mott. They're in the neighborhood of 450, 440 million years old. They're part of what's called the Ordovician period, and most of them are fossils of little shelled organisms called brachiopods, and there are also little colonial animals called bryozoa, and there actually are some trilobites in there, and there'll be some snails or gastropods. It's a what I call kind of the classic Western Vermont fossil fauna that you would also see at Button Bay or Kingsland Bay State Park and the rocks there.
Dan, are you still with us? Nope, sorry, I guess we lost Dan. Let's move on to Tony in Shelburne. Tony, welcome. Let's try Karen in Williston, and we'll see if we can get back to Tony. Karen?
Yes.
Hi, go ahead.
Hi. It's a fascinating subject. We live in an old farmhouse in Williston. It's 150 years old. It's kind of interesting because I believe it's a fairly active seismic area. Some years back, there was a big earthquake in Turkey, and it said in the paper that people in masonry houses, ours is a brick house, should watch out because we might have some damage to our houses 3 to 5 days after this earthquake. And sure enough, we got a good-sized crack. And while I was looking out the window, very shortly after the earthquake in Turkey, our woodpile fell over. And it is an interesting area because we live off of our surface wells, which are the age of the house. But we had a 600-foot well dug, which failed. And it's a very ledgy area, lots of stone. The covering on the stone is very thin, and it rises in ledges. And it's just very interesting. I was wondering whether your guests might know something about this area.
Well, let's ask first about the earthquake, and maybe not necessarily the one in Turkey, but we do have occasionally mild tremors in Vermont. It seems to me that those earthquakes, when they announce where they were centered, are always somewhere outside of Vermont. Are we just away from any kind of major seismic activity?
We actually work with emergency management in regards to the question of earthquake risk in Vermont. And just a little historical piece about that. There was an earthquake in the 1700s in Montreal that if it occurred now, there would be damage could dip into Vermont. We could dip into the damage range. If you recall, there was an earthquake back in April of 2002. Everybody felt it and woke us up in the morning, but nobody was hurt. There may have been some minor damage from that. So yes, there is some risk. One of the issues is if you're on a thicker unit of soft material left behind by the glaciers, sometimes that can amplify the wave. Mm-hmm. So you can get some more shaking in some of those areas. So we have looked at Vermont, and there are some. Again, you look at the historical record, what might occur in Vermont, and southeastern Vermont also has some issues as well. So it's a possibility in Vermont.
But you always
yes.
hear that earthquakes, and forgive me if this is oversimplifying it, are caused by where tectonic plates rub together, and that's why the Pacific Rim is such a hot area. Do we have any kind of point like that near us? Char?
Well, this area is still responding. The rocks in New England and upstate New York are still responding to stresses that were produced when the present-day Atlantic Ocean opened up. The St. Lawrence Seaway, for example, is actually part of that ocean opening. It's what we call a failed arm, meaning it's part of the rifting open of an ocean that didn't keep going. The rock holds on to that stress for quite a period of time and releases it slowly. So 60 million years ago when that rifting event happened, the rocks were under tremendous stress. And when we look at the nature of the earthquake record that's produced by the quakes in southern Quebec and in the Adirondacks, they are of a type that is related to the release of stress from that particular event. Regarding the earthquake in Turkey, there's no possibility that any damage in Vermont would be related to that particular quake, though. The rocks of the Earth's crust can't transmit stress over those huge distances. Mm-hmm. It's far more likely that there was a more local trembler. You can always go to the U.S. Geological Survey website and go to their earthquake link and find out if there was, in fact, a quake in this area at that time that maybe you didn't feel.
And, Larry, let me ask you about something else Karen mentioned, which was drilling down 600 feet to drill a well until, I don't even know, I think she said they didn't hit water at that point. How common is that, and how do you explain that?
That can happen often. The average depth in Vermont is about 250 feet, but it's really a matter of finding the water you need for your home, when you can get by with about 2 gallons per minute. Mm-hmm. So if you're drilling down, the thing that I mentioned earlier was you're trying to intercept fractures that are carrying water. Well, you could be in a block of rock that does not have fractures. And so as you work your way down, you're in the position of, well, I need water for my home, and I started this drill. So you have to go further until you can encounter the water. And then you get the deep well actually have some storage in the borehole. So you can get by under those conditions as well.
On to John, who's calling from Essex this evening. Welcome to Switchboard, John.
Hello. I have a question about Lake Champlain history and the somewhat recent geological history. I read a book about the geology of the Lake Champlain region, and, of course, it's fairly complicated. I think over the last million years or so, there was the Champlain Sea, and then there was Lake Vermont. But I'm referring now to a period, perhaps the last glacial period, which might have been, I imagine, about 10,000 years ago, as I recall. And at that time, as I think I recall something about how the flow of water in Lake Champlain has reversed itself maybe more than once. But the most recent reversal, apparently, it used to flow to the south, maybe into the Hudson River. But there was either an earthquake or some land uplifting. This might have been related to the receding of the glaciers maybe 10,000 years ago that gave us the current flow of the lake northward into the Richelieu River and the St. Lawrence Seaway. And my question is I'd just like to confirm whether or not I remember correctly, did the flow of the lake from the south change from flowing south to flowing north as it currently does as recently as when the time when man lived in this continent, perhaps 10,000 years ago or so, in other words, in the time of the Indian? And am I totally confused in the last time the lake flow got set could have been millions of years ago?
Thanks, John. Char Mertens.
Geez, John, you get an A. Slam dunk on that one. You had the dates right. You had the sequence right. That's great. The lake did, in fact, drain to the south and much more recently drained to the north. And you're right that what has controlled the drainage is primarily the elevation of the basement underneath the lake. And what has changed the water depth and also the salinity is the elevation of what we call a sill, which is literally the edge of the bathtub, just over the border of the U.S. and Canada around the Richelieu, Quebec area. And as that sill has gone up in response to removing the weight of the ice, water from the St. Lawrence estuary that is saline, was marine at the time, ceased flowing into Lake Champlain, which caused our Champlain Sea marine water, in which the shallot whale lived, to eventually evolve into the freshwater of Lake Champlain today. Now, the timing of that is actually a pretty interesting one. And again, you've got the chronology pretty well. I never actually tried to correlate that to what the Aboriginal Vermonters were doing at this time, but as far as I can tell, they certainly would have been in this area. Larry, how's your archaeology?
I'm not sure if they were in the area or not, but certainly you've gotten that there was the lobe of ice in the valley bottom, and as that moved north, the lake was trapped from going north, so it had to drain south through the Hudson drainage, and eventually the shoals of the sea came in because that lobe of ice moved north and filled the basin with salt water, and then the shoals came up, and now we have a freshwater lake.
Okay, John, thank you. Let's talk next with Tony in Shelburne. Tony?
Good evening, and thank you for taking my call. I have a question regarding Lake Champlain Basin also. This happens to be concerning the beaches in Shelburne and Charlotte. If you go there, you'll see a variety of rocks that are all very, very similar. They're black rocks, with a white crystalline material in them. And what I find striking is that these rocks range in size from very large boulders to the tiniest, tiniest pebble that's been flattened by the lake action. And I'm wondering, what are those rocks? What is the black stuff? What is the white stuff? And how did the white stuff get in the black stuff?
Char?
Great observations, Tony. The rock is called the Stony Point Shale, and a shale is a rock, sedimentary rock, that accumulates from squeezing together or compressing and then lithifying clay grains. And essentially this rock formed, again, we're back in the 450 million years ago range, in a very deep ocean basin. And the white stuff you're looking at in that black rock is the mineral calcite, which has precipitated into veins that cut through the shale as a result of the compressive forces that built the Green Mountains. So as the Green Mountains were uplifted from a plate collision hundreds of millions of years ago, the bulk of the squeezing, of course, happened in the Green Mountains themselves, but the rocks that were outboard of that to the west also were squeezed. And in fact, large slices of rock were pushed westward from the core of the Green Mountains, westward towards what today is the Lake Champlain region. And as these, we call them thrust sheets, as these thrust sheets were pushed westward, they really mangled the rock underneath them. And the calcite veining represents the material that actually was under such pressure in the shale that it got squeezed out of the shale. That fluid migrated into fractures in the rock and then crystallized out to form the mineral calcite. Because that rock is so mangled, when lake waves or even in our glacial history worked on breaking that Stony Point Shale up, it broke up into a whole series of different sized boulders. And the great stone skipping that you have at most of the beaches in Vermont, up at the Ferry Dock or places like that, essentially it's the Stony Point Shale, which has been rounded by wave action on the shoreline into those great skipping stones. But they range a whole gamut of sizes, from the size of cars all the way down to the perfect little skipping stone.
Larry Becker, Char just mentioned the formation of the mountains and how that was a result of plates pushing the earth up, and of course the effects of wave action. Can you point to a couple of features of Vermont that are, you know, well known to us that we can attribute to the glacier arriving and receding?
Lake Willoughby, some of you have been up there, beautiful lake that sits in a kind of a U-shaped valley. So, and that's a kind of a classic setting. When ice moves down through mountains, you can get a U-shape to the shape of the mountains. We also have a rounding of the mountains. If you look at Camel's Hump, for example, you have a north-facing smooth surface. And then as the ice moved over the south-facing part of Camel's Hump, it plucked off and took off pieces of rock. So you, there's actually a term in geology called Rashmutnay, which is a kind of a mountain goat type of concept, where the ice is smoothed off the north side and plucked off the south side. So that's evidence of the ice moving south. As the ice retreated, as I said, on the uplands, the ice melted first off the uplands and deposited big stones, sand and gravel, clay, fine, silty material. And in the valley bottoms, we can see, for example, there's something called a Kame Terrace, where sometimes there are gravel pits in these because it's good sand and gravel. There was a space between the walls, the valley walls, and the ice, and water would run off the ice and fill sand and gravel into that space. Now the ice is long gone, and that sits kind of high and dry. Another thing like that is that water ran underneath the ice. There were streams of water that ran underneath the ice and built up a stream bed. And now that was underneath the ice melted, and now we have a low sinuous ridge that runs along the landscape. Mm-hmm. So there are some very specific features that we look at, and that tells us the story about how the glaciers covered Vermont.
Talking today, tonight, about Vermont's geology with our two guests and welcoming your calls. We'll continue in just a moment. This is Switchboard on VPR.
Tonight on Switchboard, we're talking about what's below the surface of Vermont's landscape. Steve Zinn's guests are state geologist Larry Becker and Shar Mertens, chair of the UVM Geology Department. If you have a question or comment, give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Coming up Thursday on the next Switchboard, Fran Stoddard hosts a discussion of what makes for a happy workplace. The VPR website has audio of past Switchboard programs, VPR news, and commentaries. Just go to vpr.net. Support for VPR comes from our contributing listeners and Peter Christian's Tavern, serving comfort food and strong water since 1975, located on Main Street in New London, New Hampshire. And McSolley, McCoy & Company, certified public accountants in South Burlington, providing accounting, tax, and consulting services to businesses and individuals. Switchboard continues with host Steve Zinn.
And with caller John from Bellows Falls. John, welcome to the program.
Hi. Great program, guys. I have been panning small flakes of gold in the Saxons River, known as placer gold, and I'm curious where it comes from. The only real deposits I know of around in my area are up in Plymouth, and this is at least two or three different drainages away from that area. So gold in general in Vermont, and then How did it get here?
Well, before we go to our guests, let me ask you, are you getting rich off this, John?
Well, let's say I'm not planning my retirement around it.
Larry Becker?
Well, gold is associated often with quartz veins, and the gold can be deposited as hot fluids moved through the rocks, and gold was left behind as well as other minerals. And so it can be finely disseminated throughout the mountains, but there are certain formations that tend to have a little more of it. So when the water runs over those quartz veins with the gold in it, they can be washed down. It's a question of density when you do. We're looking at placer gold. The gold is dense, so that's what you're trying to do when you find it in the stream gravel. It's moved its way down. You look for a place where you can find some sand, and then as you swirl it in the pan, you're trying to take off the lighter fraction and save the denser fraction, and that's what we do. There are a number of places throughout Vermont. There's even a gold brook in Stowe.
And if you were someone wanted to do what John's doing, what kind of rock formation on the surface would they look for?
Well, you in this place and time, I think you're really not going to know the actual veins that it's coming from. You really just through knowing about what people say about it, possible you can get into a river and take a look at it. That's usually generally the way to do it.
Well, and since we're talking about surface features, one thing I'm curious about, can you go out anywhere in Vermont and tell by what vegetation is growing in an area what the geology of that area is?
There are certain things, for example, a certain kind of rocks in Vermont called ultramafic rocks. They were as the mountains were built and the continents were coming together, they're actually slivers of the ocean floor on a larger scale, pushed onto the land, and hot fluids move through those. And they tend to have a lot of magnesium in them. So there's something like maidenhair fern. Mm-hmm. And the question is whether it likes magnesium or just is magnesium tolerant. But you can go in the woods and you can look for the maidenhair fern, and you on these kind of older hot volcanic rocks that now greenstones are another kind, as well as some of the rocks associated with these ultramafics, serpentine and such.
I also hear anglers talk about sweet streams and not so sweet streams. Is that also a function of the geology?
Sure. Out in the Champlain Valley, we have a lot of carbonate rocks, calcium carbonate limestones. Actually, the eastern side of Vermont, a formation we call the Waits River Formation, also has a limestone in it. So if you can find certain sweet spots, even in the mountains where there shouldn't be, sometimes there's rocks that have been moved by the glaciers up into the uplands. So occasionally you will find those in the uplands where you don't expect it, but then in the valley bottoms. And that also accounts for some of our agricultural productivity, because you have more what technically you would call base saturation in the soil.
So a good angler with a geological bent could pick and choose his or her.
Sure. Definitely.
Let's go to Rick in Callis this evening. Hi, Rick.
Hi. I had a question. My wife was under the impression that during the continental drifting, that part of Africa, basically, or what is now Africa, broke off and attached itself near the Champlain Valley, and there's a record of rocks there that basically only exist also in Africa.
Charmant.
Pretty close, Rick. The piece of Africa that is closest to Vermont is really the Boston region and a little tiny fragment of easternmost Maine and some fragments of Nova Scotia. Probably the biggest contribution to the U.S. from Africa, though, would be the attachment of Florida to North America. Plates moved around over a period of a couple of hundred million years, sort of colliding and then slightly moving apart and then colliding again. And little pieces of continent that are called terranes, sort of charted places. And New England is made up of a composite of terranes, some of which were little islands with volcanoes on them and some of which were little pieces of continent, and some of those pieces of continent were attached to other continents and traded places. But the biggest exotic terrain in the sense of a place that came from somewhere else is the Boston, Narragansett, Rhode Island area. But there are some pieces of eastern Maine and Nova Scotia, too.
Thanks a lot, Rick. Here's Lisa in Williston. Hi, Lisa. Welcome to the program.
Good evening. I have a question about aquifers, which I understand are some sort of underground lakes, underground lakes. And I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit about them and tell me how are they detected scientifically. I wondered if there was a map of them, and how is that information used by Vermont geologists.
And thanks, Lisa. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I just also wanted to make a comment that listeners may be interested in checking out this book called Roadside Geology of Vermont and New Hampshire by Bradford Van Diver. Thanks.
Thank you, Lisa. We talked a little about groundwater mapping earlier in the program.
Yes, Lisa, thanks for calling in about that. Basically, we have two major aquifers in this state, and as I mentioned, fractures. You're drilling into fractures in the rock, and for the bedrock wells, and then for sand and gravel, some of the bigger municipal wells are into deposits left behind by the glaciers that are buried in saturated sand and gravel. Water is extracted from those. So as you work your way down through the level of information, knowing about the framework geology, and then you begin to do test drilling. You also, one of the things we do with looking at the fractures is we can actually look on from air photos, where we look for lineaments, lines on the air photos. Then we get on the ground and we measure the fractures on the ground.
Well, what do you mean lines or lineaments?
Well, you can look at air photos and tend to see straight lines. Some of them could be fence lines.
These from an airplane flying?
Well, we usually, photos have been shot from the air. Mm-hmm. And you can look at these at various angles and you can see a kind of a linear quality on the landscape. Some of them are fence lines and such, so you have to differentiate that. But you can't really know until you get on the ground and look at the fractures. So then we're talking about different geology units or formations and what is the fracture density in those. And some, for example, limestones, the water can move along the fractures and dissolve some of those that calcium carbonate, so they're more open. Water can move more rapidly through them. So you do some geophysical techniques where you can try to read the flow of water with some geophysical techniques, as well as drilling test wells to begin to pump those aquifers to see what their capability are.
Let me ask you, does Vermont have geographical regions? Is Newport, the Newport area, that different from the Bennington area, or is everything kind of mixed together in terms of, I don't mean geographical, geological?
Well, generally, we've had geophysical regions, and we have the Taconic Mountains to the west. We have the Champlain Valley and the Vermont Valley are related. They're the shelf environment that was a shallow sea where we have carbonate rocks that Char was talking about, sand and gravel. Sandy material that was now frozen in rock. We call it quartzite, now hardly frozen. Then we have the Green Mountains, which is the mountain building area. And then to the east, we have what's called the Piedmont. And then in the Piedmont, we have granite bodies that have been pushed through that rock. That's the Barry Granite, for example. Mm-hmm. So those are the general regions that we have in the state.
Our guests today are Larry Becker, who's Vermont State Geologist, and Char Mertens, who's chair of the UVM Geology Department. As we talk about Vermont's geology, maybe there's an interesting formation that caught your eye that you'd like to ask about, or the formation of the Taconics or Berkshires and how they differ from the Green Mountains. Any geological questions, welcome this evening on Switchboard at 1-800-639-2211. One caller wondered, is there such a thing as Vermont jade, and is it real jade, if so? Char?
Jade is the product of metamorphism of sediment which accumulates on an ocean floor, and it's associated with places along the Pacific where we've had plate collisions involving ocean floor and continent. And I would assume that you could, in some sense, consider some of the serpentines in Vermont, which are sort of a green stone, mm-hmm. To be similar to jade. But from a sort of gemological point of view, no one, I think, would call it jade. And I think also from sort of a technical mineralogical point of view, no one would call it jade.
Here's Tom in Essex for our guests. Hi, Tom.
Hi there. I was wondering, I've been hearing the news that Greenland is starting to melt, and it has huge issues in relation to sea level worldwide. And I realized that Vermont, we have a good geologic record of melting of major ice here. And as the ice melted, the land rose up, something I think called isostatic rebound, and it seemed to rise up more in the north, hypothesizing that the ice there was thicker. The question is, how long after the ice melted did it take for the isostatic rebound to occur? The second question is, how many times did the isostatic rebound occur? Did it occur in one massive movement with the land rising up after the ice melted, or did it occur in several motions? And the real question is, if Greenland melts, or if parts of the continental ice in Antarctica melt, how much isostatic rebound are we talking about? Are we talking about a couple of hundred feet, 1,000 feet, or more?
Thank you, Tom. Shaw Meritons?
Great questions, Tom. The data seems to indicate that Greenland's melting, and if the ice gets thinner, everything you described in terms of isostatic rebound will kick in. Your question about how long does isostatic rebound go on for is a great one. It goes on for probably in the neighborhood of thousands to tens of thousands of years, and this is related to the type of rock, whether the rock has the kinds of fractures that Larry's been talking about that hold water, or major fractures that where there's been movement like faults. So there's not one isostatic rebound rate. It's going to be a function of what the rock type is and whether or not it's fractured and faulted. Some of the best isostatic rebound data was done along the coast of Norway, which deglaciated slightly more recently even than the Champlain Valley, and there were some very good measurements there. We know that isostatic rebound rates are not constant, but when they start out, they're very high, in the order of meters per thousands of years. Now, geologically, that's a huge rate, because usually geologic processes are on the order of, say, centimeters per thousand years. So isostatic rebound is initially very large and rather quick, and then it will slow over time, following kind of an exponential curve. So your prediction is entirely correct, that if Greenland were to continue to deglaciate, lose its ice, it would rebound. It actually would topographically rise, and initially really pretty quickly.
Larry Becker?
Well, earlier in the program, we were talking about the outlet for Lake Champlain, and that was depressed by the weight of the ice below sea level. That presently, the shoals of the Richelieu are now at 95 feet. Now, it may have been below sea level. It was below sea level, but you can see that kind of uplift has occurred.
Let's go to Will in Craftsbury Common this evening. Hi, Will. Thanks for calling.
Hello. Thank you. I'm wondering if you could speculate out for a moment on the Lake Champlain area, 100 million or 200 million years, and speculate on what would be in the geologic history then that's happening now.
Okay, who wants to let their imagination go wild?
Well, I'll do the simple part and then leave Larry to be more creative. Great question, Will. The sediment that's accumulating in the lake right now are primarily muds. They're very fine-grained material. In the center of the lake, and of course around the edge of the lake where the Missisquoi and the Winooski and the Au Sable rivers enter the lake, there are some pretty thick accumulations of sand in the form of deltas. So I've looked at lakes in the geologic record, and I can sort of predict that Lake Champlain could produce a very similar type of deposit, where you have a rim that's coarser-grained gravels and sand deposits, and then towards the center of the lake where it's deeper and you get the finer-grained stuff settling out, you're going to have clays and silts. They probably will have a lot of microfossils in them, a lot of pollen, in other words, possibly, obviously, you know, fish remains or something like that, zebra mussel shells. And there probably will be some record of the complex structure of Lake Champlain. So the bottom is not the shape of a bathtub. It's actually a series of kind of separate little bathtubs. And those structures, which are the relic remains of the geologic history of Vermont that was associated with the fault motion, will also be structures that we'll be able to see. So that's sort of the quick paths that down the road we should have a fossil lake preserve that's kind of elongate bathtub mm-hmm. shape with the grain size trend and with a set of fossils in it that will be clearly identifiable as lacustrine.
And just to put it simply, will Vermont look very different to whoever's around?
Well,
point in the
doubtful
distant future.
We would be there to see it, but yes, it would clearly look very, very different.
Larry?
Well, looking back 200 million years ago, all the continents were together in one huge continent called Pangaea, and the continents broke up, and now we have an ocean, Atlantic Ocean, about 3,000 miles wide, I'm sorry. And so to project out that far could be a enormous changes, so it would be hard to say exactly. On the short term, I agree with Shar, and where we're going to see that in the future is really speculation at this point.
Okay, to Warren, who's been waiting in Brandon. Warren, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I wanted to turn the focus to Bennington and the new Bennington bypass. I think it's labeled 279 to New York. It cuts across Whipstock Hill, and there's a spectacular new road cut. I'm wondering if your speakers have seen that road cut. It has a very severe folding and apparently a faulting of the fold. And I wondered if they had any further explanation of how that was formed.
Larry Becker, are you familiar with that?
Yes, I actually haven't been there, but I've seen many pictures
What's
of that.
What's it look like?
Basically, what the Pocola described, it's got kind of a lighter colored rock, as well as some darker tannish look, as some and a grayer look as well. And this is again from the forces of the continents coming together, where you had calcium carbonate type of rock that was laid down on a shallow sea, and the forces of the mountain building have folded that rock, and then as the rock was folded, it broke. And so that's, I think the caller is very, very correct in that seeing the fold and the break in the rock.
And you just explained how it took place.
Yeah.
All right, thanks for the call. On to, well, let's talk to Joan in Randolph Center. Hi, Joan.
Hi. Hello?
Hi, go ahead.
This is actually for Larry. Hi, Larry. It's Joan Sachs from Water First. How are you?
Oh, yeah. Hi. How are you doing?
We were a citizens group in Randolph Center and Randolph that lobbied to get a water mapping bill passed by the legislature so that we could know what our water resources are, because our usage is not static. We have increased development, and we have, unfortunately, increased individual use that we really have to work on, so that even water-rich Vermont has had some water shortages and so forth. So that was another use of the, you know, I think you put it very well, Larry, something, didn't you, what did you said about use of resources or something like that, that you put of how the water mapping can be used?
Yes, thank you.
What did you say? You said, I've forgotten the expression that you used, but it was very apt and very pertinent because, of course, if we don't have enough water, we don't have anything. So what, I've forgotten what it was that you used, but I...
Do you have a question, Joan?
Yeah, I mean, I wanted to know what Larry used as that earlier in the program because I thought it was very good how he used the word for... the water mapping. I mean, what someone, a person asked what water mapping would do. And Larry used an answer that
we
I
may have to go to the tape for that one, Joan.
Well, I'll say certainly it's health and well-being. It's a resource that we need for our economic growth, but also it needs to be protected because it's a precious resource. And so the mapping to me is a, you come back, you step back and have an objective look at the vessel, the geology, and the water that's moving through it. And in that sense, you have kind of a template to bring to a town or any kind of planning group that here's the basic information. There are interests on many sides of the question, that, but the basic science is important to understand what is really there in terms of the resource and the nature of the geology that also provides protection as well.
I'm sorry, Joan, did you have a question?
And actually, the further question was that how long, Larry, do you think the mapping will take? In other words, if it, you know, we need, obviously we need funding for it, but how long will it take to do a sufficiently thorough water mapping so that we can get an idea of the amount of resources that we have?
Thanks.
We did give a report to the legislature about that, and in a general sense, we thought that on a regional scale, you could do this in 3 or 4 years, and then on a townwide scale, about 7 years, and you get really specific for classifying water, for example, areas that might be as much as 10 years to do the whole state.
Let's talk with Keith, who's calling from Grand Isle. Keith?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Hi. I noticed that when I drive south and Route 7, just beyond Vergennes, there's a series of undulating hills that kind of remind me of ripples, only they're quite large. And I'm just wondering if it's possible that when the sea came in, that it was a sudden rush.
Sure.
I'm not sure which hills you're referring to, but all along sort of parallel to Route 7 as you head south, there are some hills which represent the extent, the erosional remains of the extent of a large structure called the Champlain Thrust. And the main example of one of those is Mount Philo, but they continue all the way to the south, including Snake Mountain. When you look at them from north to south, they actually appear as a series of undulations, as you described, with a wavelength, but they're really not. They're erosional remnants of the main slice of rock that was pushed westward when the Green Mountains were built.
That hour flew by. I want to thank you both for coming in this evening. Shara Mertens, who's chair of the geology department at UVM, thank you.
You're very welcome.
And Larry Becker, Vermont State Geologist, thanks.
My pleasure, Steve.
Tomorrow on Vermont Edition, we'll look at the future of wind energy. Thursday on Switchboard, Fran Stoddard talks with experts about how to improve your workplace. Switchboard is produced by Patty Daniels and directed by Neil Charnoff, with production assistance from Melody Badette. Next is NPR News, and after that, jazz with George Thomas. I'm Steve Zind. Thanks for listening.
Funding for Switchboard is provided by a grant from the Lintelak Foundation, promoting research, education, and sound environmental policy for Vermont since 1975. For a CD of tonight's program, send $12 to Vermont Public Radio, 365 Troy Avenue, Colchester, Vermont, 05446. That's VPR 365 Troy Avenue, Colchester, Vermont, 05446. Please include the date and subject of tonight's program.
Thanks for checking out this edition of Switchboard from Vermont Public Radio. This podcast is made possible by VPR and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a contributing member at vpr.net.